Shrink Wrap Radio number 782. Psychotherapist Jennifer Sweeten, PhD, on 8 key brain areas of mental health and illness.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jennifer Sweeten, PhD. She is the author of the new book, 8 Key Brain Areas of Mental Health and Illness, which will be the focus of our discussion. Dr. Sweeten is a clinical psychologist, best-selling author, and internationally recognized expert on trauma, anxiety, and neuroscience. Based in Kansas City, Kansas, she has trained more than 15,000 clinicians in all 50 U.S. states and in over 20 countries. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jennifer Sweeten, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm really thrilled to have you. We're going to be discussing your book, 8 Key Brain Areas of Mental Health and Illness. A brave topic to take on, I must say. I'll put your bio into the show notes so that people can read it, but it's really too extensive to cover it all here. I have to say you are a super high achiever, and people can look at the show notes if they want to see everything that's behind that. And do I understand that you're currently in law school as well?
Yes, just finished my first semester.
Wow. So what motivated that?
Well, I do clinical psych work. I'm a clinical psychologist, but I'm also a forensic psychologist and really have an interest in forensic psychology and also a little more of the legal side of things. And so it was really that experience that prompted me to pursue the law degree. And, you know, that way life is never boring.
Yeah. Well, my wife went to law school, and also one of my adult sons went to law school. And what I know about that is the reading is massive.
Yeah. You know, it's a little bit better than writing, I'm finding. I'm liking the break from writing and getting to read. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, writing, you really have to, you have to use your brain to write.
Definitely.
So what's the story behind this book? You know, why this particular book at this particular time?
Well, I've been wanting to write a book like this, focusing on the neuroscience of mental health, probably for maybe 5 to 7 years. I really thought it was important just coming from my neuroscience background. So I was originally trained as a neuroscientist. And so that really informs a lot of my work and a lot of ways that I just view mental health and clinical psychology. And so I wanted to be able to give clinicians and even members of a lay audience some background into the brain and what brain science has to say about these topics. Because I think when we can understand more about what's happening in the brain, what's going not so great maybe in something like depression, it also tells us a little bit about what we can do to help shape the brain in healthy and positive ways. So I think it can really bolster treatment.
Yeah, and you described this book as a handbook. Tell us a little bit about what's behind that.
Well, I wanted it to be something that's fairly easy to reference. I wanted different chapters to stand on their own. So I didn't want it to have to be something that you have to read from cover to cover. I know how difficult that can be, and people are really busy, but I want it to be something where clinicians or other people can look in the book, get straight to the brain areas that they're interested in, cut to the chase, see what they're involved in, what the treatment implications are, to be able to be maximally helpful as fast as possible. The issue sometimes with brain science, as you might know, or neuroscience studies, is that they're very long, very verbose, a lot of jargon, difficult to make much of it. And so I really wanted to make it a little more digestible.
Well, how did you get your education in it? You point out that you're trained as a clinical psychologist. So at some point, you must have had to take this on in a big way.
Yeah. So really, a lot of my training came from undergrad studies in cognitive psychology. But also then when I first went to Stanford, it was for affective neuroscience. So I have a master's in affective neuroscience, which is basically, you know, emotion in the brain and looking at mental health and illness in the brain. So having that master's degree is really has given me a step up, I guess you could say. So that's where a lot of it came from. Although, of course, I have to stay up to date as things are constantly changing in that
world. I know. We're living in such a time of explosive growth in terms of neuroscience, and it's hard to keep up with all of that. And I would think it's hard for the general practitioner, psychotherapist, to know which parts are the most important to master. So your book seems like really important to help people who are maybe pondering those dilemmas. I've been retired from psychotherapy for a number of years, so this will be handy for me, maybe for future interviews as well.
Good. Yeah, hopefully some things can really click for you. Sometimes it's validating. I know clinicians will sometimes tell me, because what they've seen to be true anecdotally, or what we know to be evidence-based, you know it, but maybe you don't really know why. And so it can be helpful to really connect those dots and say, it's because it's, downregulating the amygdala that this sort of technique would work, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, we are living in a time when our brains are being stressed perhaps more than ever. And so it behooves us to understand just what's what in the brain, I guess, and to try to keep our brains as healthy as we can. So it must have been difficult. Well, I'm wondering how you decided on 8 brain areas. Could it have been more? Could it have been less?
Absolutely. It could be probably 15. Say up to 15. It can be as little as 3. If I had to narrow it down to 3, I could. I honestly started with the book as being 10. The reason why it ended up being 8 is because that's the number of brain areas that I felt confident enough about, based on the research, to say these are really critical in mental health and illness, and the critical piece of, there's evidence that we have, there's research that we have that shows us how therapy can change these areas of the brain. So there are maybe some areas of the brain that, we know they're involved in some way, but they're harder to pinpoint, or we don't really know if they can be shifted. So I'm trying to, stay hopeful and say, these are the areas that are involved that we know we can shift.
I'm just curious, what were the 2 areas that you decided to drop? To go from 10 to 8.
Okay. Let me think. Okay. So the basal ganglia, which of course is like a set of small interconnected structures. So it was like the basal ganglia. And I'm trying to think what else it was. I'm not even remembering offhand the other one that it was. So I don't even know. I know the basal ganglia was one of them. And I know the prefrontal cortex, I used to have the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex as one area. And I actually ended up splitting them. Yeah. So it's evolved over time for sure. But thankfully the publisher was flexible with me.
Now, how did you decide on what order to present these centers in the book?
Yeah, I'm presenting the chapters, you can think mainly from bottom up in your brain. So roughly, I might have broken the rule once or twice, but generally what I'm thinking of conceptually is we're going to start in the lowest part of your brain, and we're going to work our way up talking about all the important areas. And so, for instance, the first structure that we talk about is the thalamus, because the thalamus, we know, is the first structure that receives sensory input. So that's kind of where it all starts. So we start there. Where we end is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is at the very top of your head. So,
yeah,
if you were to drill into your skull from the top.
Yeah, well, so, that really made a lot of sense to me that you started at the bottom, what sometimes is called the old brain or the lizard brain, and so the functions become more complex as we work our way up.
Right.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. Now, you came to a structure, a kind of outline maybe for a key discussion points that you followed a pattern for each of the brain structures. For example, the first one was location. What are the others? I didn't write them down.
Yeah. Okay. And I have the book right here in front of me.
Oh, good. Yeah. Hold it up so people can get a sense of the heft.
Yes.
And I have to congratulate you. I mean, this book is extremely rich, and it's less than 200 pages long, which is amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
Oh, my gosh. I was actually shocked just how long it felt, the manuscript, that it fit into a book this size. Yeah. But this is good. The sections. So what you can count on, every chapter is very similar in terms of how it's structured. Yeah. Starts off with chapter 2 on the structure's location. Then it goes to the functions, but really more in a nutshell. So if you just need to read about a paragraph of general what it does, there it is.
I love that.
And then I expand it in sections beyond that, showing, like, for instance, for the hippocampus, that it's involved in stress management, timekeeping, spatial navigation. So generally, what do these structures do? What are they involved in? And then I get into more of the mental health side. So mental health conditions that we know it plays some role in. And then we have sections for those, each of those mental health, I guess, conditions or categories of disorders and treatment implications.
Okay. Well, you've already I'd like to move through them. And we may not have time to go through all of them. And besides, we want to make sure that people are have a little mystery about the book. Don't feel
sure.
Like they got all the information in this conversation, which let me assure you that listeners and viewers, no matter what depth we get into here, it's unlikely that I'll get into the depth that's in the book. And so you mentioned the thalamus, and so where is that located?
Yeah, this is a low subcortical structure. Subcortical meaning outside of conscious awareness and outside of conscious control. So I like to think of subcortical structures as being maybe about ear level and below. So the thalamus is subcortical. It's mainly involved in the relay of sensory information. So this is like one of the first areas of your brain that receives sensory information from all of your senses except smell. But every other sense except that.
Except smell, you say.
Because
the smell's got a more direct route. Is that right?
Yeah. Smell goes directly to the amygdala.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it does not pass through the thalamus, which is really interesting because basically what it means is that scent or sense of smell is really emotional for us because it's not filtered through any brain structure before hitting the amygdala, which is that limbic area of the brain that detects threat and danger.
Yeah.
And it's involved in implicit memory. So kind of interesting.
I'm wondering if it's the same in animals like dogs and bears. I don't know if you'll know this, but I just know that smell is so much more important to them than to us. And it's just such a powerful sense for them.
Yeah, I would be willing to bet it probably goes to the amygdala.
Again,
given how important it is, but I don't know for sure. Good question.
Yeah. Well, and I was also intrigued to see that the thalamus plays a crucial role in non-REM sleep. I've been longstanding interest in dreams and the meaning of dreams and so on.
Yeah. And its relationship to sleep is somewhat debated, somewhat complex. But we know it does tend to play a role in non-REM sleep. It's kind of hard with that piece of information to say how it translates into clinical practice exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. But you can kind of think about its role in sleep, and then you think about something like anxiety or PTSD, where there's difficulty with sleep and there's dysregulation of the thalamus, and it's like, all right, you see how all these problems can interact and maybe why sleep is a particular problem for most people who are anxious or traumatized.
Well, that was one of the things that really impressed me as I went up the brainstem into the cortical areas, is how a lot of these functions are not located in just one place.
Right.
They're kind of distributed. And as you go up, you get either more enriched versions, or you know, they get elaborated in some way or another.
Well, mm-hmm.
And then also, parallel to that is more pathological disorders get attached to as we go up. But in the thalamus, you touch base with short-term memory and also traumatic memories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, something kind of, I think that, of course, I specialize in trauma and PTSD. And so I'm always thinking about these structures related to that. But that with the thalamus, re-experiencing symptoms tend to be linked to underactivation or hypoactivation, which may mean, of course, as a neuroscientist, you're always telling stories. It's hard to tell exactly what causes what are the reasons for things, but it seems to be that what's happening with re-experiencing symptoms, maybe like flashbacks or intrusive memories, is that there's less filtering out of sensory information. So if the thalamus's job is to filter information and send that information, that sensory information, to other areas of the brain, when it's underactive, essentially what's happening is that it's not filtering very well. So you're feeling too much of something as though it's real, but it's not real. It's a memory, which means it should be filtered out more.
Yeah, but that sort of helps to account for the fact that that trauma can be so primal and can be imprinted at such a deep level that it can be very hard to get over it, right? Because a big part of it is way beneath consciousness.
Absolutely. I would say most of it is. I think about like the old school psychoanalysts and them saying that a goal of therapy is to bring what's not conscious into consciousness, and how right. helpful that can be when you can bring some of this awareness up to these top areas of the brain to help learn about yourself and your experiences and to regulate them. But yeah, so much of trauma, I say, is sort of ear level down. It's really in the body. It's in these subcortical areas.
Yes.
And we're, I think, as therapists, constantly struggling to help people bring it up to these top areas and into consciousness and learn how to work with these lower brain areas that we don't have as much direct access to.
Right. And so you've kind of maybe had to reach a little bit more in terms of thinking, well, how might a psychotherapist make an intervention in the thalamus? And you suggest that EMDR might be helpful and cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yes. And maybe a thousand other things. That's, you know, neuroscience research is so exciting, but it's so limited. And what's out there is random. You know, you'll find a study on progressive muscle relaxation and then nothing on other things. And then one study will look at, you know, sleep in the amygdala or something. So we know, I am trying to kind of give a view in the book of what we know right now, according to research. But yeah, exposure-based therapies, and EMDR was the one I believe looked at in multiple studies with the thalamus, can help regulate the thalamus. Also some cognitive behavioral approaches.
Something you said sparked something, but I'm forgetting. I'm sure it'll come back to me as we move on. I guess what it was that the other thing that came through to me is that all of this is so new that there's not that much that's totally solid. And people are finding, you know, because of their specialties or whatever, they might report on this or that. And so it must have really been a challenge for you to figure out, okay, what is there enough of reported here for me to include and what's maybe just kind of a random other thing.
Exactly, which is why I didn't really settle into these eight areas until late in writing the book, because there were multiple times where I'd start to write something and then back off of it.
Oh, I can believe it.
Maybe
I
want to write about addiction, but I'm like, wait a minute, we don't know enough about that. I'm going to have to switch over to depression. So you don't really know what's there until you dig really deep. And sometimes there's just not enough to say anything helpful. So that was ongoing.
I can totally believe it. And it also emphasizes that we're really talking about a holistic system. And so even to talk about centers, maybe, you know, brain centers may be a little bit arbitrary.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's a particular challenge with the thalamus and actually multiple areas of the brain, probably all of them that I'm writing about to some extent, but especially with the thalamus, where one of the main issues and figuring out what helps or what's what is that we don't know to what extent something is a result of the thalamus or a result of what the thalamus is connected to. So the connections between different areas of the brain, the networks that are connecting these different regions are really important. And it can be hard to kind of pull out like this is just what the thalamus does.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My hat's off to you. So we get on the elevator and go up to the next floor and we come to the amygdala.
The amygdala. The amygdala next. Yes. Yeah.
So tell us a bit about where that's located and what the nutshell understanding of it is.
Well, and the amygdala is the nice next step progression, because the thalamus, when it reroutes sensory information to other areas of the brain, the first area it gets to is the amygdala. So the amygdala, tiny little subcortical structure, almond-shaped structure that is little but mighty, involved mainly in threat detection. So sometimes it's referred to as the smoke detector. I know Bessel van der Kolk calls it the smoke detector of the brain. It's there to keep you alive, to keep you safe, to detect any sort of danger that you might be faced with. And so in a lot of different disorders, what happens is that this threat detection center becomes a little bit too sensitive, where maybe you are perceiving threat where there is no threat, or maybe there is some kind of stressor, but you're disproportionately reacting to it. So it's hyper-reactive, or you feel like when you get upset, you just can't calm down. So these are all issues that can happen with the amygdala.
Yeah. And another thing that totally amazes me is that you pointed out that it's a small structure, almond-shaped structure. And I don't know if this is one of them, but many of these structures, when you talk about them, they're divided into multiple parts, and there's the top part and the bottom part, and they do different things. Talk about complexity. So there are two amazing things there. One is the complexity that you were able to deal with, and the other is just how so much is able to happen in such small structures.
Yes, and this is a perfect example, though, of how your connections in your brain are everything. With the amygdala, it's tiny but mighty. Really, the reason why it's so powerful and influential is that its connections are really strong. Because it's a survival area of the brain, it's there to light up, to activate, to save your life. For instance, if a bear is chasing you, because of that, its connections going to other brain areas tend to be incredibly strong, meaning it can influence those other structures. It can shut down those other structures. It can take over, essentially. So it's really the wiring, I think, that makes the amygdala so powerful.
And you also indicate that in terms of therapeutic interventions, you point to connections with anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, trauma, PTSD, and depression. Now, that's a lot. That's a big mix.
And everything else, right? Unless you're talking about antisocial personality disorder, in which case you'd have underactivation, actually, of the amygdala. But for the most part, if what you're working with a client has a strong stress component, probably has some amygdala activation.
Okay.
Yeah.
So going up the elevator to the next floor, we come to the hippocampus. That's such an interesting word. What does hippocampus mean? Do you know?
Yeah.
Some of them you're able to trace.
It was Latin. Okay. I hate for you to quote me on this, but I believe it's Latin for like seahorse.
That sounds familiar. I'm sure it's in your book. If we were looking in your book. No, you don't have to look it up.
But yeah, I think it's Latin for like seahorse because it has like that seahorse kind of shape. There's multiple. This is one of those brain areas kind of like you were talking about, have multiple sections that we know. Each section does something a little bit different, or like long-term memory is stored in one place in the hippocampus for the first 2 years, and then it actually shifts to another. So I don't go into that much detail because that could just be too much for people.
Oh,
I'm trying to, like, what do you need to know?
You're treading a narrow.
Complicated.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But this is long-term memory storage. It's not the only area. I mean, memory systems and the brain are really, really complex, but it's involved in the encoding and the storage of long-term memories and the retrieval as well. So really, really important, especially if you're working with anxiety, where the anxiety is rooted in some sort of past event that was distressing, or if you're working with trauma or PTSD, where people essentially are going off of memories of, you know, terrible things that have happened, and it's impacting their life.
Yeah, you say memory encoding, and also consolidation, which makes me think of a reconsolidation theory and therapy.
Yes.
So do you think that gets at this area somehow?
Absolutely. So if you think about something like EMDR, where you're bringing to mind a thought of a memory or a part of a memory, and then you're incorporating the bilateral movement to facilitate desensitization to that memory, that is memory reconsolidation, right? Memory reconsolidation is bringing the memory to mind. Uh-huh. That activates the hippocampus and also the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So activates those two areas of the brain. Then what you're doing is you're altering, not the facts of the memory, but you're altering your relationship to the memory in a way where it's going to feel less distressing over time. And so memory reconsolidation has that piece too, which is that repetitive exposure to the memory, adding in some sort of contradictory experience. So it might be that now you feel less upset when you think about it, or maybe you can take a deep breath as you're thinking about it. And so now when it reconsolidates into the hippocampus, you store it back essentially, you're storing it back into the hippocampus a little less distressing than when you pulled it out. Because we know the way memory reconsolidation works is that every time you remember something, you're remembering the last time you remembered it. It's not the original trace anymore. And that's why we can actually shift memories over.
And also why our memories get less accurate as time goes on, right?
Sure. Little parts fade out over time.
It's like the game of telephone where you pass along something, you know, in a circle with other people, and it gets changed.
And that
becomes relevant, you know, in court cases where they're relying on witness testimony.
And that's major interest of mine,
Law school, you're going to be getting into that. So some of the things that you show are implicated are, again, trauma, depression, and anxiety. Addiction starts to appear now as we move our way up. Epileptic seizures, that was an interesting one. And schizophrenia, that's the first time that one's popped into. We're going to see it again as we move up.
Yeah, it's a good point. I hadn't actually put that pattern together until you told it to me. But as we go up, you start to see more disorders and sometimes more severe mental illness.
Yeah. So now we come to the insula.
Yes. Arguably my favorite area. So the insula is a limbic structure, also a pretty low structure, really cool area of the brain that helps you form emotion with the help of other brain regions. But it alerts you to what's happening in your body and then helps you make sense of it and craft emotions from it. So classic example is if you notice that your heart is racing, the second that you notice your heart is racing, that's the insula. It's actually the back end, the posterior insula, alerting you that something's happening in your body. And as the signal moves through the insula to the front part, what happens is you interpret it. You decide if this racing heart is aversive, or if it's pleasant. And then you put in some sort of interpretive statement or appraisal on it with the help of the anterior cingulate cortex, which might be my heart's racing because I love roller coasters and they're so exciting, or my heart's racing because I hate roller coasters and I'm really afraid. So it's kind of how we interpret situations based on our body.
And so the I'm kind of looking at the kind of outline they made from these, and I see implicated in many mental disorders. So we see this multiplication that we were talking about, including trauma, anxiety. And I thought this is interesting. You say the treatment focus is to get them into their body and in the here and now. And so we see mindfulness also as a possible approach to working with it.
Sure, sure. And different types of mindfulness maybe are more helpful than others. But yeah, a key way to increase activation of this area is to intentionally bring the client's awareness to their body and what's happening in their body, and actually being able to feel it, experience it, name it, describe it. So that's really, really important, because in a lot of disorders, what happens, it depends, but what can happen is that this area becomes less activated than we would like it to be, which means the person may be unaware of what they're feeling. They may be alexithymic, meaning they have a hard time describing emotions or experiencing them. Mm. They might feel numbed out. And so it can be difficult to engage fully in therapy if you don't really know who you are, how you feel. No,
yeah, that's hard. A frequently reported experience.
Absolutely.
And we also have depression, addiction, schizophrenia, and autism. Now, addiction is going to show up as we move up more and more. What is it about the insula that somehow ties into addiction?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. So one of the ways that this is going to be linked is that through, and it depends on what you're addicted to, right? But through meth, the use of meth, let's say, you can actually shut off the insula. So we know that a big reason why people engage in substance use or abuse is to get away from feelings that they don't want. Sometimes they'll say it's so that I can stop thinking about things that I don't want to think about, but it's not really the thoughts. It's what the thoughts produce in the body when they have the thoughts. It's the feelings, essentially. And so we know substances can be a great way to shut that off and to stop feeling. So I look at insula underactivation really as most people's goal when they're experiencing addiction. That's really what they're trying to do, is stop feeling bad. And so that's understandable. It's just that it's impacting their brain in some not great ways.
Yeah. Okay, let's go up to another one. The nucleus accumbens. Do you have any idea what accumbens means?
I don't actually know what that is. Yeah, pretty interesting area. Again, a limbic or emotional area of the brain. Speaking of addiction, definitely that's like the area of the brain that's talked about the most in addiction research. Mm-hmm. This is an area of the brain that's involved in reinforcement. It's part of your reward system of the brain. Okay. So it's, I would say, like the key, like one of the key pieces. Sometimes it's referred to as the addiction hub or the addiction center, because it's that site of reinforcement. It's also associated with things like pleasure, but I try not to really emphasize that part, because people can become addicted to all sorts of things that don't actually bring them pleasure, but that are somehow reinforcing. So when you have nucleus accumbens activation, you have dopamine, it means that whatever you're doing feels reinforcing and you're going to do more of it. You do want some nucleus accumbens activation, but you want it to be in response to, like, you know, petting your cat and hanging out with your friends and things like that. What you don't want it to get wired to is something like alcohol or drugs, pornography, you know, things like that, where then it's kind of like the nucleus accumbens wires itself to that thing.
Yeah.
And you actually stop getting nucleus accumbens activation for other naturally rewarding things like people and hobbies and, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned love and attachment as being also related to that area of the nucleus accumbens.
Right. Right. Yeah, so you want activation in that area, but you don't want too much. That's usually what's key.
Okay. Okay. And I'm also beginning to think that I'm remembering that it's for some of these things like neurofeedback can be, you know, to really try to reach down into the brain and make some actual differences. Well, I say actual differences because I keep having to remind myself that talk therapy makes differences in brains too.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But I mean, to be fair, you know, there's something like deep brain stimulation or something like that, or neurofeedback, which might make more targeted changes a little bit faster is a way to think about it. Yeah. Sometimes for some people in certain areas.
Yes, right. And transmagnetic stimulation is another approach that that we're starting to hear about here and there and that you mentioned. And I think that's a really very interesting and exciting area of possible research and intervention because you don't have to plunge wires deep into the brain to make some direct intervention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, well, I said we wouldn't go through all of them, but maybe we will. but not in total depth, right? So now we get up to the anterior cingulate cortex. I'm never going to remember all this. I don't know how you do it. The anterior cingulate cortex. Tell us about that. Where's it located?
The anterior cingulate cortex. It is, this is kind of interesting. It's a limbic area of the brain, meaning it's kind of deep in your brain and a little bit lower down, but not very low down. Okay, it's where it's located is right underneath the prefrontal cortex, which is kind of behind your forehead. So we're moving up in the brain. It is a really cool structure because it's a limbic structure, meaning really involved in emotion, but it's also a cortical structure. So it's also involved in things like rational thinking. So it's a cognitive structure. It's an emotional structure. It does a little bit of both. Really, really important for self-regulation in general. So regulating your thoughts, regulating your behaviors, regulating your emotions. Technically, you have something called a VACC and a DACC, which is like the lower area of the ACC and the top area of the ACC, where the top area is more cognitive, not surprisingly. Bottom area, a little more emotional, but it all together is really involved in self-regulation. When there's a thought that bothers you and you don't want to have it, or there's an emotion that you're experiencing is distressing and you're trying to kind of like, you know, talk yourself out of it or make yourself feel better. I mean, these are functions of the cingulate.
Yeah, it's interesting that as we go up, then there are structures like this one where it's got some of the qualities of the lower, right?
Right.
So some of the primitive, more primitive brain and some of the functions that were moving up towards the cortical area. And so it begins to be involved in processes that we would associate with the cortex.
That's right. Yeah. Kind of the best of a couple of worlds.
Okay. Pardon me. And that one, you mentioned exposure therapy, CBT, EMDR, addiction and depression.
A lot. Yeah. The kind of the good thing about this as a large structure is that there's a lot of things you can do to strengthen it. And that's usually the goal in therapy with the anterior cingulate is to strengthen it because the more powerful it is, the stronger it is, the more you can talk yourself out of being in a crummy mood. You can actually begin to shift your thinking better. If you go to therapy and your therapist tells you to look at something from a little bit of a different angle or engage in cognitive restructuring, you can actually do that when you have strong cingulate activation. It can also play a role in downregulating the amygdala along with the prefrontal cortex. So if you have an amygdala that's sending off fear signals, but really it was just the cat jumped off the counter and startled you, and you don't want to feel anxious for the next 3 hours, the cingulate can step in and say, hey, that was then, this is now, you're safe now, it's the cat, your doors are locked, and you can actually feel calmer with your thoughts. So really, this is a super important area for therapy.
So moving up, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So, you talked about, well, maybe the prefrontal, you didn't know whether to include that, but we're up getting up in that area now.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, ventromedial prefrontal cortex, I mean, you could just say it's part of the larger prefrontal cortex, which goes all the way across your forehead. If you were to drill into your brain, it's the first thing you hit right here. So huge area. But some notable distinctions, I think, between the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, ventromedial being here in the center. So you kind of think of it as midline.
Yeah, medial is middle. Okay.
Uh-huh. And ventro is actually a little bit down, a little bit under. Okay.
Yeah,
so a little bit
under.
Down.
That's what you said, a little under.
Kind of like your third eye here, where dorsolateral is more the outer areas of the prefrontal cortex.
Dorsolateral is number 8. That's the final one that we're going to discuss. Right. So when we talk about teenagers having a underdeveloped prefrontal cortex, are we talking about either the ventromedial or the dorsolateral?
Both. You know, you can see this with the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, that rapid development, for instance, in adolescence, when people are trying to find themselves and they're changing the color of their hair and they're trying to think about how they want to dress. And they have that spotlight effect where they think everything they do, people are scrutinizing them and paying attention to them.
Yeah.
That's the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is involved in self-perception and identity. It's coming into being. But at the same time, you see some really terrible decision-making, maybe lack of focus and concentration. They're not problem-solving very well. You ask a teenager why they did something and they say, I don't know, or I didn't think about it. You know, both are...
Yeah.
True, but that's dorsolateral prefrontal cortex under development is they're not able to really imagine things in the future or future consequences as well as adults. So they're not ready yet maybe for some of life's bigger decisions.
Yeah. Okay. And let's see, what have we got here? The dorsal, we've got the dorsolateral, the ventromedial. This has been a good exercise in learning what some of these words mean, like medial and ventral and dorsal. And there are a whole bunch of, which makes sense because we need a language to talk about location of physical structures. Yeah.
Yes.
So I guess we come back to the question of, okay, so I'm a psychotherapist. How is this really, why is this important to me? Why do I need to know this?
Yeah, I think it's important to know a little bit about what you're aiming to help clients shift. You know, to be able to link symptoms to brain areas and then link it to different types of therapeutic techniques. We know what's evidence-based for the most part. It's always shifting, but we know where the research is, but that doesn't really narrow it down. I mean, if you look at something like prolonged exposure for PTSD, we know that it's associated with clinically significant reductions in PTSD symptoms in about, 51% of clients, which is great. But what about when it's not? Or how do you know at the outset who you should try prolonged exposure with? When should we be doing an exposure-based therapy versus something more somatic versus something more cognitive? And I think the answer, we don't know the answers to this in a super nuanced way yet, but the answer is it depends on which of their symptoms are most salient and what it implies about what's going on in the brain. So we know that if a person's amygdala is so on fire, so activated that they can't even focus on something, hold something in mind, then we probably shouldn't be doing prolonged exposure. Or if they're prone to dissociation where they can talk about the trauma, but they're not even emotionally connected to it, we know prolonged exposure is not going to be super helpful. So even though we know what these evidence-based therapies are, sometimes we don't really know when to use them or in what order or how in a way that's maximally effective. But when you have some idea about different areas of the brain and what they do and the types of techniques that help those areas, I think it gives us a better starting point.
I think for a long time, I think of the saying, give a small boy a hammer and everything looks like a nail. And in a sense, there have been therapies, different schools of therapy. And hey, this is my school of therapy and we're going to do this pretty much on everybody who walks in the door.
Right.
And it seems like we're shifting away from that. toward a more nuanced ability to differentiate. I remember when I was a graduate student a millennia ago, that I used to wonder, you know, why are we doing all of this diagnostic stuff if we treat everybody more or less the same?
That's so funny.
Yeah, well, I really wondered about that. Yeah.
Yeah, we tend to be told sometimes, I think, that these certain approaches are these panaceas, like, you know, here's one thing and it's going to work for everyone. And that's a common thing that I think you just see in a lot of different trainings for a lot of psychotherapies. I mean, I've been to prolonged exposure trainings and cognitive processing therapy trainings and brain spotting ones and EMDR, and they all
work for somebody, right?
They all work for someone, but sometimes you get this impression that if it's not working for your clients, you're not doing the therapy right. But really, we might be targeting not necessarily the wrong brain areas, but the wrong brain areas at the wrong time, right? Maybe it's the right areas at the wrong time. So if we understand, for instance, that sometimes we have to address amygdala activation before we can strengthen the prefrontal cortex, that gives you an idea of the order of operations of good treatment, right? So you know, okay, maybe if, let's say, just as an extreme example, your spouse just died yesterday. So today, you're probably not going to go to therapy and have the therapist say, hey, let's try to think about this a little bit differently. It's not the end of the world, right? You're not going to be doing cognitive restructuring. And we know this intuitively, but sometimes these therapies push us to doing maybe some of the right work, but not at the right time for a client. Yeah. You know, so amygdala activation first, lower areas of the brain first. If someone can't even feel their body or describe an emotion, probably can't do emotional work until they're in their body. So that's what neuroscience can give us, is a better sense of when we should do what types of techniques.
I would imagine that one of the implications of your book is that the training of psychotherapists is going to have to develop and become more nuanced. It already seems like it's terribly. There's an awful lot that new therapists have to master, but it seems like it's going to get even more challenging.
Yeah. I think ideally it will. And I am hoping that over time we, you know, we have our areas of specialty, but to move beyond, I am a cognitive behavioral therapist or I am an EMDR therapist, and think about these as tools for brain change, but focusing more on this is the condition that I treat with several tools rather than the kind of one size approach that you were referencing.
Or I'm imagining that there might be a co-pilot, if you will, a person like yourself that the therapist could consult to get a sense of direction and so on in terms of all of this brain knowledge.
Absolutely. I do those consultations frequently for people, even just in 15-minute increments where somebody just needs to know, hey, this is the way someone is presenting. What is this? Or what might this be? And then what are the techniques for this?
Yeah. Well, you are on the cutting edge, I must say. And I really thank you for the time that you spent going through all of this. So Dr. Jennifer Sweeten, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Wow. Dr. Jennifer Sweeten is a real superstar. Not only is her book, 8 Key Brain Areas of Mental Health and Illness, extraordinary, but a glance at her bio in our show notes will reveal a lifelong overachiever. For example, she completed her doctoral training at the Stanford University School of Medicine, the Pacific Graduate School of Psychology, and the National Center for PTSD. Additionally, she holds a master's degree in personality psychology with an emphasis on effective neuroscience from Stanford University, and studied behavioral genetics and psychopathology at Harvard University. In addition to all that and more, she is currently in the first year of law school, while also running several businesses. Does this woman ever sleep? Her brain areas book, which we discuss in the interview, is really intended as a handbook for busy therapists who don't have the bandwidth to master the ever-changing and exploding world of neuroscience, especially as it relates to psychotherapy. In fact, it occurs to me that this handbook is something like the brain itself, inasmuch as both store an incredible amount of information in a small space. Her book is less than 200 pages, making it a handy resource indeed. The book focuses on 8 brain areas, starting from the brain stem up to just below the cortex. The 8 brain areas are 1. The thalamus, 2. The amygdala, 3. The hippocampus, 4. The insula, 5. The nucleus accumbens, 6. The anterior cingulate cortex, 7. The ventromedial prefrontal cortex, and 8. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. For each of these, she gives the derivation of the name and the location in the brain. She goes on to give a nutshell description of the function or functions served by that area, as well as paragraphs on the pathologies associated with each area and some indication of the therapies that might be best suited for targeting the given areas. There are also mostly recent journal references embedded in the text. Beyond this, there are some graphics picturing the location in the brain of each area and some useful tables. I'm impressed by the amount of labor it will have taken to locate and summarize all this information and the tightrope she had to walk in separating these brain areas and deciding what information was relevant and current. After all, the brain and even the whole body are holistic systems that don't submit easily to parsing out in pieces. So clearly, I think Dr. Sweetin is an especially gifted scholar and clinician. I feel certain this handbook will serve both therapists and interested laypeople well. Once again, the book is 8 Key Brain Areas of Mental Health and Illness by Jennifer Sweetin, Ph.D. Longtime donor Terry Keller dropped me an email that reads, quote, "Your work is so important, I can't even put it into words. You are helping so many exponentially, and I couldn't think of a more deserving, fitting person / cause to send this donation to. Hope you are doing well, and I wish an amazing new year and future for you and yours. Thank you, Terry, for your long time and continuing monthly donations. Thank you also for your happy new year wish. Right back at you. You all may have noticed a change in my voice. Unfortunately, I've just come down with COVID. Actually, I'm in my 3rd day of it now. Also, 2 of my adult sons and my wife are all currently down with COVID. Each person's suffering is different. So far, mine feels like a really bad cold. I hope to have kicked it by the next interview. We'll see. Let this be a reminder to you all to mask up and keep physically distance. By the way, we all were double vaccinated and boosted. We did take a chance at being unmasked at a family Christmas dinner, and we suspect that's what did us in. Time to shrink wrap it up once again. Thanks to today's guest, psychotherapist Jennifer Sweetin, for sharing her book, 8 Key Brain Areas of Mental Health and Illness. Next week, we'll be speaking with Dr. Elise Brenner, Ph.D., and Nancy Spatz, M.D., about their book, Reiki, A Self-Practice to Live in Peace with Self and Others. Just in time for some needed self-soothing. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.